RFK pick gives him a shot in the arm. It's no longer Barbie and Kim in New Jersey. And we remember a groundbreaking running mate on The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 412 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. For the longest time, discussion about third-party presidential candidates centered more on which major party candidate they would take votes from. They never seem like there's a shot of them winning, just who gets hurt and who gets helped. Ralph Nader got just 1.6% of the vote in Florida in 2000, but it was enough, some will argue, to cost Al Gore the election. Jill Stein picked up enough votes in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania in 2016 to theoretically deny Hillary Clinton the win, though many will argue Clinton could have done a better job on her own candidacy. Note, by the way, that both Gore and Clinton won the popular vote. And to this day, people are still debating who was hurt more, George Bush or Bill Clinton, by the 19 million votes Ross Perot received in 1992. The independent candidate people are focusing on this year is Robert Kennedy Jr., son of the late senator. He is a noted environmentalist, with admirers on the left, but also a fierce critic of vaccines and follower of bizarre conspiracy theories, which helps him attract support from Trumpers and Fox News. Last week, he announced his running mate, Nicole Shanahan, a political unknown from Silicon Valley who has one attribute that makes her most attractive, deep pockets. 38 years old, she's the ex-wife of the co-founder of Google. Her money will especially be needed in the expensive task of trying to qualify to get on all 50 state ballots.
The Democratic Party is supposed to be the party of compassion. It is supposed to be the party of diplomacy and science. It is supposed to be the party of civil liberties and free speech, and most importantly, the party of the middle class and the American dream. While I know many Democrats still abide by those values, I want to point out, and I've been in touch with many people in the Democratic Party, I do believe they've lost their way in their leadership.
The debate on what RFK brings, or takes away, from the race is already in full swing. Fox News, which had Kennedy on their air after the Shanahan announcement, still seems to see him as a conservative.
We have a conservative base that every political party watches Fox, but a lot of conservatives like Fox. They like where you stand on vaccines, men playing in women's sports, immigration. What other conservative issues do you have that will appeal to those voters?
And here's Kennedy's response to the question in a CNN interview about which candidate is worse for democracy.
Listen, I can make the argument that President Biden is a much worse threat to democracy. And the reason for that is President Biden is the first candidate in history, the first president in history that has used the federal agencies to censor political speech, so to censor his opponent. I can say that because I just won a case in the Federal Court of Appeals and now before the Supreme Court. It shows that he started censoring not just me. 37 hours after he took the oath of office, he was censoring me. No president in the country has ever done that. The greatest threat to democracy is not somebody who questions election returns, but a president of the United States who used the power of his office to force the social media companies, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, to open a portal and give the access to that portal to the FBI, to the CIA, to the IRS, to CISA, to NIH, to censor his political critics. President Biden, for the first president in history, to use the secret, his power over the Secret Service, to deny Secret Service protection to one of his political opponents for political reasons. He's weaponizing the federal agencies.
And here was Donald Trump 9 months ago on Newsmax, when Kennedy was still in the race as a Democratic primary challenger to Biden.
I will say RFK Jr., who I've known
Not very well, but I've known for a while, and I respect him. A lot of people respect him. He's got some very important points to be made. No, he's a respected person.
And again last July on Fox's Sunday Morning Futures.
He's a very smart person, yeah. I know a lot of the members of that family, and, you know, he's a very smart guy. And he's hit a little bit of a nerve, I think he really has, and a lot of Democrats I know want to vote for him.
It was easy for Trump to praise Kennedy as long as he was a Democratic opponent to Biden. But now that he's an independent candidate, Trump sees him differently. He went on Truth Social last week to say, quote, RFK Jr. is the most radical left candidate in the race, by far. He's a big fan of the Green New Scam and other economy-killing disasters. I guess this would mean he's going to be taking votes from crooked Joe Biden, which would be a great service to America. His running mate, Nicole Shanahan, is even more liberal than him, if that's possible. Kennedy is a radical left Democrat and always will be! Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. It's great for MAGA, but the communists will make it very hard for him to get on the ballot. Expect him and her to be indicted any day now, probably for environmental fraud. He is crooked Joe Biden's political opponent, not mine. I love that he is running. Gotta love Truth Social. This means, actually nobody ever knows what Trump is thinking, but this could mean that Trump is worried that Kennedy will wind up hurting him, and he's using the old Democratic tactic of attacking him in order to get progressive voters drawn to the Kennedy bandwagon. For now, with 7 months to go, Kennedy is pulling double-digit numbers in the polls. He still has to get on the ballot, but now he has a running mate who could make that possible. And here's some Senate news you may have missed. In New Jersey, Tammy Murphy, the wife of Democratic Governor Phil Murphy, dropped out of the race for the seat of indicted Democrat Bob Menendez. Her relationship with the governor led many leaders in the party to back her, a first-time candidate who until a few years ago was a registered Republican. But she was still trailing badly in the polls to Congressman Andy Kim, clearly misreading the reaction by voters that her marriage somehow qualified her for the Senate.
After many busy, invigorating, and yes, challenging months, I am suspending my Senate campaign today. I have been genuine and factual throughout, but it is clear to me that continuing in this race will involve waging a very divisive and negative campaign, which I am not willing to do. And with Donald Trump on the ballot and so much at stake for our nation, I will not, in good conscience, waste resources tearing down a fellow Democrat.
Kim is now the clear frontrunner for the nomination, if not the seat itself. Last month, Menendez, who's facing bribery charges that are likely to doom his political future, was trailing badly in the primary. While he still stubbornly refuses to resign his seat, let alone drop his bid for re-election, he conceded one thing last month. He would not run in the Democratic primary.
Unfortunately, the present accusations I am facing, of which I am innocent and will prove so, will not allow me to have that type of dialogue and debate with political opponents that have already made it the cornerstone of their campaign. New Jerseyans deserve better than that. You deserve to hear from those who wish to represent you about what they would do for you and your families in the future. Therefore, I will not file for the Democratic primary this June. I am hopeful that my exoneration will take place this summer and allow me to pursue my candidacy as an independent Democrat in the general election.
But the guess is that an unfavorable jury verdict will force his hand not to run again. There hasn't been a competitive Senate primary in Jersey since 2000, when millionaire outsider John Corzine bought up support in his big victory over Jim Florio, a former governor. The last non-incumbent Republican to win was Clifford Case in 1954. Case's re-election in 1972 was the last GOP Senate victory in the state. It's not that the TV networks haven't hired partisans before. Diane Sawyer, who rose to anchoring ABC's World News Tonight, was originally a staffer with Nixon Press Secretary Ron Ziegler and later a close aide to the former president. Tim Russert, a top aide to New York Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan and later Governor Mario Cuomo, became the Washington bureau chief for NBC News and the longest host in the history of its famed Meet the Press. Former Florida Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough hosts the Morning Joe program on MSNBC, as does civil rights activist and former Democratic presidential candidate Al Sharpton. So does Michael Steele, a predecessor to McDaniel as RNC chair. Top Bill Clinton aide George Stephanopoulos is the moderator for This Week on ABC. Longtime Obama fixture David Axelrod is a pundit on CNN. And former George W. Bush communications chief Nicole Wallace is regularly heard on MSNBC. Other political partisans, such as Karl Rove, David Gergen, Jen Psaki, Donna Brazile, Lawrence O'Donnell, Paul Begala, Chris Matthews, the list is endless. All play or played prominent roles on TV news programs. So why is Ronald McDaniel different? McDaniel served as chair of the Republican National Committee from 2017, when Donald Trump became president, and played a key role in Trump's denial of the 2020 election results and his effort to hold onto power with the use of fake electors. McDaniel served as GOP chair until last month when Trump forced her out. In March, NBC News said it hired her as a contributor. She appeared as a guest on Meet the Press, questioned by moderator Kristen Welker.
Joining me now is former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel. Ronna, welcome back to Meet the Press. Thank you for being here.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Let's dive right into this and start with your decision to step down as RNC chair. If you can, take me behind the scenes a little bit. Were you pushed out of your role?
But her job at the network didn't last long. A stunning on-air mutiny by its top political stars forced NBC brass to reverse course and end her employment after just 4 days. So what made Ronald McDaniel so unacceptable in an industry where political partisans have long been part of the system? For that, I turned to David Folkenflik, the media correspondent for NPR. He's also the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. David, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Ken, it's great talking with you again.
It's great. Thank you. Well, before we start, what does the hiring of a political operative, especially one with White House experience, bring to a TV network?
There are two ways of thinking about it. One is that you will get an insider's view. How does the White House work? How does somebody make decisions? Who is he surrounding himself with or herself with? What are their priorities? What is the nature of their character? Now that they're out of government or out of partisan employ, presumably she or he, whomever it might be able to give you something of the real inside scoop. Yes, probably sympathetic, unless there's been some sharp break with your former employer or patron. But, you know, something giving you more insight than you can have from the outside. I mean, these are the kinds of people you and I at NPR thought of or described as sources, right? Well, if they're on your team, maybe they're giving you the good dish, the inside scoop. And secondly, or separately, sometimes it's congruent, sometimes they're in conflict, it gives you access, that you are essentially paying your way to have somebody on side who can say, all right, I can get the calls returned even if you can't, or I'm going to play the role of a professional Democrat or a professional Republican on the air so that it looks like you're in the loop and it looks like you care about what people on that party or that administration or in that rooting section believe and feel. And so you're kind of buying your way toward a source, but you're also, there's a performative element to it by having the imprimatur of the network on the commentator, not just having them on the air, but paying them to be on your team. It's saying we care enough to spend our money and to give our seal of approval of letterhead to this source. And it's seen, has at least conventionally been seen as a way networks get around being accused of being biased against or in favor of this person or that.
Well, speaking of bias, I mean, conservatives have long said that the media are too liberal. They have little interest in hearing viewpoints from the right. And that might explain why in the old days there were the hirings of William Sapphire, Diane Sawyer, David Gergen, and other Republicans. Alyssa Farah Griffin, who served in the Trump administration, is often on CNN opinion panels. And when even when the leftish MSNBC hired Nicole Wallace, a top official in the George W. Bush administration, who's, George Bush was hardly a media darling, there was very little pushback. But the hiring of Ronna McDaniel was different. Why?
Well, first off, I think it matters what phase you're talking about MSNBC in. Wallace was hired at a time the network was trying to figure out if it could retreat a bit from its straight left of center lineup. And it was trying to vary things somewhat. Then Wallace really found her voice as Trump, Donald Trump emerged as the leading candidate of Republicans into the full-fledged, in some ways, somewhat authoritarian-minded figure that she broke with. She ultimately said that she's no longer a Republican and found herself sort of, cheered and toasted on the left as a result. She also turned out to be a pretty decent broadcaster, a smart person. Not all of these revolutions through the revolving door work in one direction or another, right? So when Ronna McDaniel came on board, it was a very interesting and complicated thing. She didn't come on just to any broadcast network. She didn't go on to ABC or CBS. Why does that matter? Well, NBC, of course, has this very liberal cousin in MSNBC. And for NBC, it was a very conventional hire. So it sounds like, well, this is just what you do. You get people from the right, you get people from the left. Maybe, if the Bernie Sanders wing is ascendant, you get somebody from the more leftist part of the Democratic Party as part of your things. This is just normal. Well, MSNBC rejected the idea of Ronna McDaniel. And there are two things that I think really stood out. And you could argue that journalists not simply at MSNBC, but at other outlets would have taken objection to it as well. The first thing is that she repeatedly attacked the press. As you mentioned in your introduction, she attacked its not just its performance in specific instances, but its legitimacy. She embraced, I think, the rhetorical antagonism of then-President Trump during his presidency. She explicitly called for the dismissal of Richard Engel, a foreign correspondent for NBC. Last spring, she called MSNBC's primetime hosts propagandists. I don't think there's too many worlds in which for primetime left-of-center hosts on MSNBC, they're going to feel it appeals to their audiences whose ratings they crave and need for success to embrace Ronna McDaniel. And the second thing is just obvious, but it has to be said. She was defending Trump after January 6th, and that makes her very different than Mick Mulvaney, who had been out of office for months by that point. That makes her different to other people, and many of whom broke with Trump as a result of his encouragement of the people who laid siege to the U.S. Capitol and his efforts in the month preceding to argue, not just in court, but privately and pressuring public officials out of public view to essentially deny Joe Biden the rightful certification of his election. And the complication, particularly for Ronna McDaniel, and that one is she had participated with Trump on calls in her home state of Michigan to pressure local county-level election officials not to certify Biden's win and never walked it back, never said this was wrong, never said Biden was legitimate. She always found ways to hedge and say, well, there are questions. Sure, there are all kinds of questions. Are there legitimate questions? Are there questions on anything like the order that would suggest that any of these votes were in doubt? None. No. Rejected dozens, scores of times in court by Republican and Democratic elected officials and judges. And she hadn't walked that back until she went on the air on NBC, on Meet the Press with Kristen Welker as a paid employee of NBC News. So that was the problem there for her colleagues, even as MSNBC has an ideological reason to object her as well.
And, the funny thing about her is that, I mean, when all is said and done, the Trumpers hate her and the left despises her. So why hire her? I mean, what does she bring?
Well, she brings a surface level of credibility, but you're 100% right. I mean, she wasn't Trumpy enough for Trump, and she wasn't anti-Trumpy enough for MSNBC or even some other journalists. So, you know, she's in some ways a Hobson's choice of a paid pundit. She gives NBC the verisimilitude, the seeming presentation of, hey, we are fair-minded not just to Republicans, but to Republicans who are not anti-Trump. And that is the complication of the current moment, is that let's say this is okay, this world. You know, I've argued publicly that I think there are real fundamental questions about paying partisan figures at all to be commentators in this way, unless they are making a transition to a different career. Like if you look at, I think this is important to note, if you look at Diane Sawyer, she left the Nixon, actually the post-White House Nixon staff, right? As well as the Nixon White House staff. And she became part of 60 Minutes ultimately at CBS and then moved to ABC and spent, you know, many, many, many decades as a journalist. It seems to me that you can fairly say she has just different chapters of her life. David Gergen went through the revolving door a number of times and ultimately ended up sort of a consummate voice of the establishment. But my sense was, my feeling was when he was at U.S. News and World Report, when he was a commentator for CNN, he really was trying to unpack and explain what happens in government and what he argued should happen in government, as opposed to trying to push one side or the other. And in fact, although he served three Republican administrations, he ultimately served briefly with Bill Clinton as well as a Democrat. Somebody like McDaniel seems to me to be kind of parking herself as a professional Republican who happens to be in front of the Klieg lights and television cameras, probably in some ways auditioning for her next even more lucrative role, with no great standing for anybody, you know, devalued by pro-Trump Republicans, rejected by anti-Trump Republicans, not likely to, you know, I mean, the proof's in the pudding. Maybe she would have been on the air. She would have been dazzling and said, okay, I can now tell you the real truth. And then she could have been riveting. But I think, you know, the way you do that is bring somebody on bit by bit and let them prove themselves as a source and then decide, all right, this person is making a transition. I had no, she never offered any sense of that. What she said simply was, well, you know, sometimes you have to kind of take one for the team. And that's how she explained away her involvement in trying to deny Joe Biden the presidency.
Yeah, I kind of saw her when I saw her on Meet the Press. It seemed like she was trying to inch towards the fact that she did separate herself from Trump on many occasions. But of course, there's the record and there's her rhetoric from that day. And so, as you say, it's not just the fact that she was a Trumper. I mean, the fact that she was a Trumper on January 6th and after. I mean, Jen Psaki, one would think that as White House press secretary, she had to bend the truth now and then defending President Biden. What I'm trying to say is it wasn't that Ronald McDaniel was a Republican or even a Trumper. She was a post-January 6th Trumper, and that is anathema to news.
I think right. I think it's anathema to fact.
That's what
it's
I mean.
It's anathema to the Constitution. And, you know, I don't think that the, what shall I say? I don't think the First Amendment is some sort of nihilistic suicide pact where you have to say that everything is equal and there is no fact or meaning, because then what's the point in our doing investigations? I think that there is something offensive about bringing someone on who has furthered lies so repeatedly. And part of it is that if you accept the best case scenario of it, it's that she didn't believe any of it, because she hasn't made any dramatic break. She hasn't said, oh my God, this information came to light and I view this differently, or I've just understood something fundamentally about the false claims that were pushed out to the public that forced Fox News, by the way, let's not forget, to pay more than $750 million to settle a defamation suit just from one single voter tech company, right? If she had had some epiphany and said, I've realized that I was wrong, then, you know, it's a problem. But it's a problem that she's working through. She hasn't said that. So if she hasn't said that, and then she comes on and she's speaking much more clear, with clearer eyes and clearer sense of where truth can be found, then it suggests everything is cynical. that nothing that's said in Washington has any fixed value, and that it's just a game between the people who come on the air and say things, the people who put that on the air and say, well, this is a broadcast in which we try to get to the truth, you know, that all of it is just a cynical game. And maybe that cuts a little too close to the bone for certain, broadcast news executives in the commercial sphere. But to me, I think that's a problem. So again, this was a very conventional choice. It makes sense by every standard logic of every era we've been in prior to, call it, 2016. You know, it's not that these issues weren't raised about somebody like Nicole Wallace, who's part of the Bush administration, where many people on the left said the Bush people lied us into war. But in this case, you don't have that to fall back on. You know, all the stuff at Fox, all of the documents that came to light about that showed that the executives and the reporters and the hosts, the opinion hosts and the board members of Fox Corp, none of them believed in this stuff, except perhaps Maria Bartiromo. But they pushed it out anyway because it's what the audience needed to hear.
Let me play a little tape from some of the NBC talent that was initially outraged by McDaniel's hiring. First, you're going to hear Chuck Todd, the former host of Meet the Press, during the roundtable immediately after McDaniel's appearance on the program, and then MSNBC star Rachel Maddow the following night.
Look, let me deal with the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
I think our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation, because I don't know what to believe. She is now a paid contributor by NBC News. So I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract. Mm. She wants us to believe that she was speaking for the RNC when the RNC was paying for it. And look, there's a reason why there's a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting, have been met with character assassination. So it is, that's where you begin here. And so when NBC made the decision to give her NBC News' credibility, you got to ask yourself, what does she bring NBC News?
And so I want to associate myself with all my colleagues, both at MSNBC and at NBC News, who have voiced loud and principled objections to our company putting on the payroll someone who hasn't just attacked us as journalists, but someone who is part of an ongoing project to get rid of our system of government. Someone who still is trying to convince Americans that this election stuff, it doesn't really work. That this last election, it wasn't a real result. That American elections are fraudulent. Because that argument, that is a necessary part, that is the most necessary part of the overall project of getting us as Americans to give up on this election stuff. Because wouldn't we rather have a real man in charge anyway? Somebody who could really get some stuff done. If only we could clear away all the things in his way.
So it was incredibly striking to see, essentially morning, afternoon and night, the biggest names, the MSNBC roster, an occasionally fractious group being united in their antipathy towards this appointment. You had Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski attack this. You had Nicole Wallace in the afternoon. Joy Reid picked it up. Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell. Chris Hayes chimed in the next day. He said, I'm off Mondays, otherwise I would have done it too. And, this was essentially the host body rejecting the graft.
That was pretty remarkable, wasn't it? Just when I watched Chuck on Meet the Press, I said, whoa, what's his boss is going to say to that? And then when everybody followed suit, when suddenly Chuck Todd was no longer an aberration and everybody was along, I said, my goodness, I don't remember a time when news people rebelled against their own network and they won.
Chuck Todd doing this because he used to host Meet the Press, because he's NBC's political director, and because he has taken on or sought to take on, particularly in leaving the host chair, a lot of the bigger issues of journalism. It gave MSNBC hosts cover to do this, because if somebody from the straight news side is able to do it, there's no reason why the, left of center outlet, why its stars can't take exception to this as well. It does, there is no doubt but that this serves to reinforce the belief of Republicans on the right, many of whom I heard from in the hours and days after this started to play out, that, you know, MSNBC, that NBC, and by extension, the mainstream press other than Fox, really can't tolerate Republicans in its ranks. I don't think that's true to the facts, but it is true to the feelings of what, and for audiences, that's often almost as important.
Well, that leads to this question. Do you think it makes it more difficult for NBC to get Republicans on its air?
I think it, you know, it's almost as though they have to have people from the Trump era who left government before November, the first week of November 2020. And if they don't do that, they will be, unless the person has broken, like Farah had with Trump over this issue, you know, it's going to be very hard for them to have them on board as a team member. Doesn't mean they can't be interviewed. I mean, my whole position on this is unless people are making a specific turn out of a role of government into one in journalism, I think that it's really problematic. CNN, the first time I really wrote about this intently, I think it was 2008, you had CNN's broadcast when Barack Obama was nominated at the convention, and it was a historic moment, 100% by a charismatic young figure. Understandable, a lot of people would be moved by that. CNN shows two of its commentators, Paul Begala and Donna Brazile, basically dancing in glee and delight. And that's lovely. But, you know, Donna Brazile was at that time a superdelegate to the Democratic National Committee. And later on was found, I think, in 2015 to have fed some of the questions that CNN was going to ask at a town hall to Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. Like, that's just wrong. It's just too complicated. She now has worked for, I think, ABC and somebody else, you know, but.
And Fox.
And Fox. She's now at Fox, of course, which has no such compunctions about such things. But, you know. She's so smart. She's actually smart and she's a good analyst. But, you know, who are her loyalties to? Is it to the audience? Is it to her colleagues at the network? Is it to the principles of holding other people to account, shining light in the corners and corridors of power that maybe the powerful don't want illuminated? Or is it to her side, her team?
The Democratic Party.
Are you just hiring somebody from the Dodgers to put them in the broadcast booth and waiting for them, you know, paying them to be a commentator on the game before they get called to, you know, pitch in relief in the seventh?
You know, I thought it was interesting. The RNC has hinted that NBC may be barred from covering its convention in July in Milwaukee because the network fired her, but the RNC fired her as well, you know. So,
yeah, so that's right. Donald Trump, basically exiled her from the Republican National Convention first. You know, presumably she'd be able to show up like any professional Republican. But, you know, it's the height of hypocrisy.
But, you know, if half the country wants Donald Trump back in the White House and polls have indicated that, what responsibility do the networks have to air someone or to have someone on their air reflecting that point of view? I mean, other than Fox, of course. I mean, maybe the difference is they don't have to have them in their employ and they can have them as just, you know, on-air guests. But that point of view, if it is half the country, needs to be expressed.
I do think you put your finger on the point there. I think there absolutely should be in reported stories as well as analyses, pro-Trump voices reflected, whether to explore, why he's able to draw on that reservoir of support or how people feel about certain policies, or if they're professional politicians, you know, give some insight into what's going on. I don't understand entirely at this point the value of having the paid analysts, you know, who have clear partisan uniforms on from anything. Like, I'm not sure why you need to pay a Joe Biden thing. Jen Psaki is now a host, and I guess the proof will be in the pudding, but they didn't take a long time to make that transition, right? It was pretty quick from being an analyst contributor to being a host, which is to say a star. You know, I would say put these people on the air and let them earn the respect and show that they're capable of both great insight of really drilling down and also some degree of independence. You know, I don't think that you need pro-Biden people on the payroll either. I do understand that if you're hiring somebody and they're making a change in careers and professional life, then you need them to demonstrate that their loyalties no longer lie primarily with the figure that they once represented.
So I'm assuming from what you're saying that the practice of hiring partisan voices are not going to come to an end, even hiring people who bend the truth to suit their needs.
I think it's a very conventional way to think about it. I do think that, you know, this is a moment, you know, cable channels are under some revenue pressures. It's an expensive thing to hire Ronna McDaniel, $300,000. But here's the secret. It's cheaper than hiring a bunch of reporters, producers, videographers and the like to go out and actually report stories and bring them back. I mean, talk is cheaper than reporting. You know, pulling in the reports by the Washington Post or Politico or NPR or other places, you know, relying on that, outsourcing not all, but much of that reporting to other outlets is cheaper. And you have the verisimilitude of news by having people chew over it and argue about it. And that's really the game that's going on here. And in some ways, that's the most cynical thing of all.
David Folkenflik is the media correspondent for NPR. David, it was great having you on the program.
Pleasure, my friend. Be well.
Joe Lieberman, a senator from Connecticut for 24 years and the Democratic nominee for vice president in 2000, died on March 27th from a fall. He was 82 years old. An Orthodox Jew and the first person of his faith to appear on a national ticket, Lieberman's sense of morality led him to speak out on the Senate floor against President Clinton's behavior during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. His long support of the war in Iraq led to his defeat in the 2006 Democratic primary by a challenger to his left. But armed with tremendous support from Republican voters, even though there was a GOP candidate in the race, Lieberman won a fourth term handily. His popularity with Democrats took another hit in 2008 when he endorsed the Republican presidential nominee over Barack Obama.
What, after all, is a Democrat like me doing at a Republican convention like this? Well, I'll tell you what. I'm here to support John McCain because country matters more than party. I am here tonight for a simple reason. John McCain is the best choice to bring our country together and lead America forward. And dear friends, I am here tonight because John McCain's whole life testifies to a great truth. Being a Democrat or a Republican is important, but it is nowhere near as important as being an American.
And as recently as this year, he was working with the group No Labels to find a so-called centrist presidential candidate to run against Biden and Trump. A candidate many Democrats felt would ultimately hurt Biden's candidacy. This week, I am repeating one of Lieberman's appearances on The Political Junkie from back in August of 2017, when he talked about his run for VP, his party's dilemma over how to deal with Bill Clinton's flaws, and how close he came to being named McCain's running mate in 2008. It's time for This Week in Political History. It was one of the first key decisions presidential candidate Al Gore made, and it was, shall we say, a bit unorthodox.
With pride in his achievements, with gratitude for his acceptance of this challenge, and with faith in his fight for working families, I'm here to announce my running mate, the next vice president of the United States, Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut.
In an era where a presidential running mate has often been seen as a hardcore partisan, the selection of Joe Lieberman was different. the first Jew ever to be part of a national ticket, Lieberman had the reputation as a fighter for bipartisanship, even if it meant taking on his own party at times. A two-term senator from Connecticut, he had friends on both sides of the aisle. He famously and publicly attacked President Bill Clinton for his behavior during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But at the same time, he was a solid Democratic vote when it came to climate change, abortion, women's rights, civil liberties, and labor issues. It was 17 years ago this week at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles when Joe Lieberman made it official.
Tonight, I am so proud to stand as your candidate for Vice President of the United States. Thank you, dear friends. I am humbled by this nomination and so grateful to Al Gore for choosing me. And I want you to know tonight that I will work my heart out to make Al Gore the next president of the United States.
Joe Lieberman has gone through quite a lot since then. The Gore-Lieberman ticket lost in November, even though it received more votes than the Republican opposition. 6 years later, Lieberman was defeated in the 2006 Democratic primary in Connecticut in his bid for a fourth Senate term, but he won re-election by running on an independent third-party ticket. And he was almost, maybe, John McCain's running mate in 2008. We'll find out right now. Joe Lieberman, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Great to be with you. I must admit, hearing some of those voices from yesteryear was quite thrilling to me.
It seems like yesterday, and it was 17 years ago. That's pretty remarkable.
Yes, I agree.
Well, you've gone from Democratic State Senate Majority Leader in Connecticut to State Attorney General to U.S. Senator to candidate for Vice President to independent Senator to almost Republican candidate for Vice President. More than 40 years in public office. It's been, shall we say, an unconventional career?
Yeah, I guess it has as I look back to it. I didn't intend it that way. I mean, part of what I did is just called every issue, every campaign as I saw it, as I thought was best. Sometimes that put me with my Democratic Party, but sometimes it didn't. And in a time of our politics, which became increasingly partisan and ideologically divided, I became, much to my surprise, the odd man out. But I look back at it, and I honestly don't regret any of that, because I feel that I did what I believed was right and best for our country at the time.
Well, the first time I met you, we were sitting next to each other on an Amtrak train going from Washington to New York. I think it was 1989, and for some congressional event related to the Constitution, you had just defeated Lowell Weicker for the Senate, and conservatives hated Weicker. I mean, William F. Buckley and the Buckley family supported you over Weicker.
Yeah.
Did that amuse you in some ways?
It did. I mean, just personal story. Bill Buckley was about 10 or 12 years older than I, but he took a real interest in the Yale Daily News, where he was editor, and I was editor. And so we got to be friends, but never. And I would go to his house in Stanford about once a year to have dinner, and great conversation. But never thought that he would endorse me. But you're right; he really despised Lowell Weicker. He called me up one day and he said, "I wish I could impersonate that great voice, Joe. I'm thinking of endorsing you. Do you think it would help?" And I said, I think it might, with Republicans are thinking about voting for me. But don't get me wrong, he said, this is the only time. So he was a lot of fun and a great thinker, had a big effect on our politics.
Okay, let me go back to move up to 2000. There was so much analysis, so much psychobabble as to why Al Gore chose you as his running mate.
Yes.
And I think, what was going to become the post-Bill Clinton era, you represented morals, decency, and values, and in some ways you were portrayed as the anti-Clinton. Do you agree with that analysis?
There may have been some of that, although the fault in it is that I was one of the earliest supporters of Bill Clinton.
Right.
Because I believed in his vision of a new Democratic Party. And though I made that speech critical of his behavior with Monica Lewinsky, I voted against convicting him for impeachment because I thought the Constitution never contemplated that person would be pushed out of office for behavior like that, particularly since he was receiving favorable support from on his general performance from more than 60% of the people. But, okay, I think maybe that was part of what was in Al Gore's mind, that I was a kind of response or even antidote to Bill Clinton. But there was something more that Bill Clinton and Al Gore and I had been part of the New Democratic Movement. I think we understood and shared beliefs about how the Democratic Party had to be not a left party, but a center-left party, and one that was open to a lot of different kinds of people. And we got to know each other, Al Gore and I, and I think at some very personal level, he knew he could trust me. I sure hope so. We were friends and still are.
Did you get any sense at the time that Gore was pulled in different directions as to how to deal with Clinton and his faults?
Yeah, I mean, I think Al Gore, I heard some of it, but really I heard some more of it from other people. That is, I could feel some of it in Al, but I think he felt that the Lewinsky scandal hung over his head as he went into the campaign. I don't know. I'm sure it didn't help. But the fact is that the Clinton-Gore administration had a tremendous record of accomplishment. I mean, I could almost recite my campaign speeches from that year. We had 22 million jobs created. And the government, believe it or not, only 17 years ago, was in surplus when Bill Clinton and Al Gore left office. So there was really a record to run on. And it's what made the election so very, very close, even though, as you know, history says that when you run as the candidate of the party that's been in for two terms as president, the odds are that you're not going to win.
As Hillary Clinton learned in 2016.
Yeah, exactly.
The Gore-Lieberman team was the first Al and Joe ticket since 1928 when Al Smith became the first Catholic nominated for president. In 2000, the Al and Joe team included the first Jew on a major ticket. That was a major point of pride for you, wasn't it?
It was a major point of pride for me and really a major point of gratitude from me toward Al Gore, because the choice that the presidential candidate makes of the running mate is one of the most unilateral choices in American politics. I mean, generally speaking, the convention is going to accept what the presidential nominee wants. And he had the confidence in the American people believe that they would not vote for me or against me because of my religion. And he was right. I mean, the fact is that the first ticket, major party ticket, on which there was a Jewish candidate, happened to be myself, did get 544,000 more votes than the Republican ticket. Now, I don't say that to relitigate the hanging chads in Florida, but simply to say what a great, fair, open, accepting people the American people are. And, of course, they proved it again in 2008 with Barack Obama.
Well, one of my favorite moments listening to the event in Nashville when Al Gore announced you as his running mate was this introduction.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States of America, Al Gore and Tipper Gore. And the next vice president of the United States, Joe Lieberman and Hadassah Lieberman.
Hadassah Lieberman.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a name he's ever heard before.
I'll tell you, Hadassah developed a method for telling people, because it was an unusual name. She said, here's what you should think. Que pasa Hadassah. I'll tell you a quick story, because this Hadassah is the child of two survivors of the Holocaust who met in Prague after the war, got married, and she was born there. And then when the communists came into control in Czechoslovakia, my father-in-law decided it was time to leave, and he came to America, thank God. Hadassah went through her life with nobody being able to say her name. And during the campaign in 2000, people learned how to say Hadassah. And afterward, we were at a Dunkin' Donut out in Silver Spring, Maryland. I can remember it, waiting for our daughter who was at basketball practice. And a police officer comes in and says, Senator Lieberman, great to see you. And then he turns to her and says, and Hadassah, what a pleasure to meet you. And he turns away, and she's crying. I said, what in God's name are you crying about? She said, that man knew how to pronounce my name. And my whole life, nobody could do it. So that's America. Well, I tell you a story in terms of being the first Jew on a national ticket, which is really a lesson. The night that I flew to Nashville before the morning that Al was going to announce my selection, he was gracious enough to invite my family to dinner with his family. And he said that he had decided about 3 weeks before that I was his choice for vice president, but he felt that he had a responsibility to talk to some close friends and advisors and ask them whether they thought America was ready for a Jewish vice president, the proverbial heartbeat away from the presidency. And he said the responses were really quite interesting. He said, I talked to some Jewish friends, and among them there was great anxiety and uncertainty about me selecting you, Joe. Then I spoke to a bunch of Christian friends, and every one of them said, no problem, Al. So Al's joke was, because I know there are so many millions more Christians in America than Jews, I was able to select you as my running mate. But of course, the story there is that the Jewish reaction to the possibility of me being on the ticket was based on Jewish history and anxiety about whether the country was ready. The Christian reaction, which was so positive, was an expression of the fact that the country was ready. And, of course, on Election Day, we found out, at least in terms of the popular vote, that it was.
Well, that's interesting. You remember when Barack Obama was first running, there were many African-Americans who said, it's not his time or it's not a time for an African-American yeah. president. And they were scared on many accounts.
Again, it's the result of history. It's yeah. understandable. But it takes somebody like Al Gore, who had the confidence to break a barrier, and then somebody like Barack Obama, who had the self-confidence to do it, to bring about progress, to challenge the American people. And generally speaking, when they are challenged to do the right thing, they do.
Back to Hadassah Lieberman.
I know
she was very active with women's health issues. How is she?
Hadassah is great. Okay. She, like I, are enjoying this chapter of our lives. We followed the migratory flight pattern of grandparents and have settled in Riverdale, New York, where we found the greatest concentration of children and grandchildren. We have one son in Atlanta with two children, a daughter in Baltimore with four kids. But we've got two up here with a total of five grandchildren. So we're very happy she is too. And you know, we just consider ourselves blessed. We've had a great life. 2000 didn't work out as we hoped it would. The whole campaign was just an extraordinarily positive experience until election night, and then less positive. But life since then has been great. I would say that I probably had my most productive years in the Senate after 2000. And now this new chapter, practicing law, teaching, working on a lot of nonprofit boards, and more time with the family has really been great.
And you're also on the Political Junkie program.
And to be on the Political Junkie program, perhaps the ultimate accomplishment.
That was the correct answer, Senator.
Yes.
I remember going back to that convention in Los Angeles, I remember one delegate telling me that she couldn't wait for the debates, the Gore debate against George W. Bush. Do you think the Democrats underestimated Bush?
Probably, although I think Al did generally well, very well in the debates. But, you know, people do benefit from low expectations.
Yeah.
And that was probably true of George W. Bush in those debates. Now, people who said he wasn't smart never convinced me because, you know, I went to Yale and George W. Bush went to Yale, and I just figured that meant he was automatically smart.
it was a self-compliment there, wasn't there?
Yeah. The debates were, you know, it was a real topsy-turvy campaign at different times. Bush was way ahead, and then we closed the gap at the end. And as we went into the last weekend, it was clear from our polling that it was going to be a 1 or 2 point race. So there was a lot of effort put into it. I'll just tell you this story. I mean, we started out classic Gore Lieberman campaign Saturday night. You know, I observed the Sabbath. The Sabbath was over. We were in Florida. I went to Little Havana, and the Cuban section had a cup of that great, strong Havana Cuban coffee. And I basically circled the country, and Al did too. I went across the whole southern border up to the northwest, across the top, and then back down, ended up in Tampa, Florida, at just before sunrise on Election Day, where Al and I joined together. We did one of the morning shows. And it was, and then I flew to New Haven to vote. And then I flew back to Nashville, where I was supposed to get a nap. And Bill Daley, the campaign chairman, called me and he said, "This is very close, and I know we promised you a nap." I had slept probably 4 hours in the preceding 3 days. And he said, "But you got to get on radio talk shows and TV interviews if you can." And one of the talk shows was in Palm Beach area in Florida with a talk show host desk named I think it was Randy Rhodes. And she said to me, "I got to tell you, people are calling me and telling me they went to vote for you and Al Gore. And the ballot was so confusing, they're worried they voted for Pat Buchanan." And, of course, that was the first I heard of that butterfly ballot. I'd let the campaign know, and they said they had heard a few other complaints, and they went to work. And that was what we focused on for the next 36 days.
You know, I once asked Michael Dukakis what he would have done differently in 1988, and he said he would have responded much quicker to the negative attack ads put out by the Republicans. Is there something you or your ticket should have done differently? I mean, other than win Florida or Tennessee or something like that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's really interesting to hear Mike Dukakis's a response to you, because that's the year I was running for senator,
that's
and
right.
I remember him coming in and telling me people were sick of the back and forth of negative ads,
that's
and just
right.
If they're negative on you, just let it be, which, of course, I didn't do. You know, I think other than, and I disagreed with the campaign decision not to use Bill Clinton in some states. I mean, they told me the polls showed that certain demographic groups went down in their support of Al Gore and me when Clinton came in. But, you know, in places like Tennessee and Arkansas, I think if we had just let him go, he's such an extraordinary political figure. A great advocate, and he was a great advocate for our ticket. Who knows what might have happened? It wouldn't have taken much. Tennessee, Arkansas, or New Hampshire. And that would have been it.
You know, I mean, we talk about the 537 votes in Florida or the 5-4 decision on the Supreme Court, but do you have those what-if moments? Do you think about that much? Like what would have been different in the country had Gore Lieberman?
Oh, I mean, afterward? Oh, I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have, by my nature, Ken, I go on. You know, I mean, when the day after we conceded, it was December by then, but the Senate, believe it or not, was still in session, and you'll never guess why. There was a budget crisis. So, but the first thing I did the next morning was to go to work. So, but listen, you've got to, as time went on, people would ask me the what-if question, and I thought about it. And I think things would have been a lot different. I mean, my guess is that after 9/11, Al Gore, as commander-in-chief, would have ordered our troops into Afghanistan to wipe out the Taliban for harboring al-Qaeda. I doubt that we would have gone into Iraq. There wouldn't have been the enormous and I think unfair tax cut that was adopted in the early months of 2001 that began to put our government into debt. And, of course, we would have done a lot more about climate change, which is a really serious to critical problem now that nothing has happened about. So, yeah, I think you can't look back and say, oh, everything would have been wonderful if only Al Gore and I had been elected. But it would have been different in those significant ways that I've just described.
Well, while I wanted to focus only on 2000, I need to ask you this. How close did you come to becoming John McCain's running mate in 2008?
I must say closer than I ever expected. And when they first told me, Rick Davis, the campaign manager, that John wanted to consider me for vice president, honestly, my reaction was, are you kidding? So he said, no, I'm not kidding. He's serious. So I said, would you please tell him he doesn't have to do this to thank me for supporting him? I'm supporting him because he's my friend. I think he's the best, and he can do this job. No, he's serious about it. And I think John did feel that the Republican Party was down in 2008, and Barack Obama was beginning to sort of walk on the clouds, you know. And he had to do something different, and one way to show that he was different was to have a Democratic running mate. But I just couldn't see, in the, as the politics was getting so divided, how he could do it. But he and I rarely talked about it. Lindsey Graham, our third amigo, declared himself my campaign manager within the campaign. And he would periodically tell me, we got this one. Well, I'm not sure about that one. But in the end, I think they convinced John that his choosing me would divide the Republican Party, and it would make the convention awful messy. And so he but it really, I think he clung to it, the idea, because we're friends and we agree on so much. We disagree on things also, but I think he felt that what a statement this would make to America, that we're having a bipartisan ticket. And but his party, and it would have been the same in the Democratic Party if the tables were turned, essentially said to him, don't do it. So he did something else that he thought was different. He needed a Hail Mary, and he went for
Hail Sarah.
Hail Sarah, right.
Any thoughts on McCain's role during last month's health care debate in the Senate?
Well, I thought it was one of the great moments of a great career, of a patriot. So first off, he's not feeling well. He's just come off of surgery, a bad diagnosis. But he brings those strength together. He comes back. He looks pretty good, really. And but he's not just going to show up and get a round of applause. He's going to use the moment to say what he really believes, which is the Congress and the president are messed up and they're not serving the country. And he used the Senate term. We got to go back to the regular order, meaning bills have to start in committees where Republicans and Democrats generally work together, and they got to negotiate and compromise so that something can come out that gets something done. And then he has the real guts to vote against the so-called skinny repeal of Obamacare. And I think that vote was not, it was a vote against the skinny repeal, but really it was a vote that was saying, I meant everything I said in my remarks a couple of days ago. This this process here in Washington is screwed up. And we can do better than this bill, and therefore I'm going to vote against it and hope that we do.
And how much do you miss the Senate? None whatsoever?
No, the truth is that I was 40 years in elective office, so and I never wanted to expire in office. So it's been great to be out and to face the new challenges of returning to law practice, teaching, being on some boards, et cetera, more time with the family. Every now and then I read something. Or I hear something that's happened, and I wish I was down there to call up McCain or Susan Collins and say, hey, let's try to do this to fix this. But I will tell you the truth, Ken, it passes quickly.
Yes, I understand that completely. Joe Lieberman is a former four-term senator from Connecticut who was the Democratic Party's candidate for vice president in 2000. He's currently the senior counsel at Cassowitz Benson Torres, LLP. Senator Lieberman, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Great to be with you, Ken. Thanks for your love of politics and public service, which comes through everything you do.
That was my interview with Joe Lieberman back in August of 2017. Lieberman died last month at the age of 82.
Isn't life strange? A turn of the page. Can read like before. Can we ask for more? Each day passes by. How hard man will try. The sea will not taste, you know it may.
That's it for this week's show. Don't forget, you can always find my political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet me at Ken Rudin or shoot me a message on the show's Facebook page. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is made possible thanks to the support of our listeners and donors. Your generous contributions are most appreciated. Keep them coming at krpoliticaljunkie.com/donate. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. Please stay safe. I'll see you soon.
Isn't love strange? A word we arrange with no thought or care. Maker of despair. Each breath that we breathe will